And good morning and welcome to this June 1st, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org, and we are always available via podcast. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do every single Wednesday morning, which is talk with authors not only about their books, but about their writing process and creativity and craft and all the things that go into creating compelling work. This morning we're doing what I don't do often enough, or I do it, but I don't do it often enough. I realized the last time I did it was in 2009. So we are past due for a show on poetry. We talk a lot with fiction writers about the importance of reading poetry and perhaps writing poetry and how it informs their fiction and their writing. But today we're really going to talk to the poets themselves in a roundtable poetry panel discussion. I have three incredible poets with me this morning: Kim Dower, Tess Taylor, and Dean Rader. Kim's first collection of poetry, Air Kissing on Mars, was the Poetry Foundation's contemporary bestsellers list. Slice of Moon, her second collection, was nominated for a Pushcart, and her latest is Last Train to the Missing Planet. All three were published by Red Hen Press. Kim's work has been featured in Garrison Keillor's The Writer's Almanac and Ted Kusser's American Life in Poetry, as well as in Plowshares and other journals. Her poems are anthologized. She also owns a book publicity company called Kim from LA Literary and Media Services, and teaches a workshop called Poetry and Dreaming in the BA program of Antioch University. She joins us this morning from West Hollywood, and Tess Taylor's inaugural chapbook, The Misremembered World, was selected and published by the Poetry Society of America. Since then, her work has appeared in The New Yorker, the Academy of American Poets, the New York Times, all over. The San Francisco Chronicle called her first book, The Forage House, stunning. It was a finalist for the Believer Poetry Award. Her latest collection is Work and Days. It's also published by Red Hen, and she serves on the board of the National Book Circuit's Critics Circle Award and the on-air poetry reviewer for NPR's All Things Considered. Dean has been published widely in the fields of poetry, American Indian studies, and popular culture. His debut collection of poems, Works and Days, we're going to talk about the, they both have collections called Works and Days, won the 2010 T.S. Eliot Poetry Prize, was a finalist for the Bob Bush Memorial Award, and won the 2010 Writers League of Texas Poetry Prize. 2011, he was a finalist for the Poetry Society of America's Lewis Hammer Award, and his poem Self-Portrait as Dido to Anisus was selected for Best American Poetry in 2012. His most recent collection of poems, Landscape Portrait Figure Form, was named by Barnes & Noble's Poetry Review as the best poetry book of 2013. His newest collection of poems, Self-Portrait as Wikipedia Entry, is forthcoming from Copper Canyon Press in 2016. I could go on and on about Dean. He's got so many interesting things going on, including 99 poems for the 99%, which I want to hear more about, the Frankenstein Sonnets, which I want to hear more about, but I want to get them on. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome.
Hello.
I know it's hard to do a poetry panel, and I want to tell you that though I'm moderating it, feel free to also talk amongst each other if you have, you know, if somebody brings up a point and somebody else wants to talk about it. You know, I just love these getting smart, talented, creative people together and listening to them talk. So I hope we can do that too. But to get us started, Kim, maybe you can get us started and sort of introduce your background, kind of your draw to poetry, what got you interested. And then in a minute, I'll let you introduce your collection. But just for right now, just kind of introduce yourself and your draw to poetry.
Sure. Well, I think very different from the two other poets we have here. I am not in an academic world. I actually have a business, and I'm not in a university, so I feel a little removed from the world day to day. But I started being interested in poetry when I was very young, and would write when I was, you know, like probably all of us, you know, would write in my little notebook. And when I went to college, I went to Emerson College, and I was blessed with these fabulous teachers, Thomas Lux, when he, you know, very young poets at the time, and fell in love with poetry and wrote seriously, taught creative writing at Emerson for 2 years when I graduated. And until suddenly I wanted to leave Boston, and I felt kind of isolated from the world. So I left, moved to Los Angeles, and started a new life, a business, a family, and poetry sort of stopped for me for a long time. I didn't write it seriously, though I kept reading it. And 25 years went by, and my son was out of the house, and suddenly it came back to me. And I think this is my story, is how it came back really furiously, and I was writing 2-3 poems a day, and it was like a fever, actually, and that was 10 years ago. So I've had the 3 collections in the 10 years. I write every day. I'm immersed in it, yet I carry on my business and my life. Poetry is finding its way, back to me. Or I guess it found its way. So that's my story in a nutshell.
I love it. I love it. Tess, can you jump in and kind of talk about your entry into it?
Well, as a kid, I was training really hard as a musician, actually. I was in the San Francisco Girls Chorus, and I thought I was going to be a soprano that sang opera. And weirdly, I had a kind of a late adolescent crisis of faith and decided that I wanted to drop out of that world, took up smoking and singing jazz and stuff, and started studying poetry really seriously. But poetry was kind of a strange thing to study really seriously because I'd never really considered it, and when I stumbled into a class that was led by a very charismatic teacher at my college, I just got hooked. And I realized I had all of this training in memorizing lyrics and in music and in sort of the form of sound. And I also realized that I had this hunger to write, but I wasn't very interested in fiction. I didn't really care what happened when people went to buy milk, like what they thought or, what happened next to them in that kind of plot-driven way. But I was really interested in the music of language and, like, how the word song can make meaning. Or, if you think of Robert Frost's poem, Stopping by the Woods on a Snowy Evening, like, nothing happens in that poem. But somebody stops by the woods on a snowy evening and then decides not to go into them. I mean, it was just a complete snoozer on the level of plot. But it's absolutely charged on the level of music. And when he says, the woods are lovely, dark, and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep and miles to go before I sleep. So I got really fascinated with this dense musical space where nothing happens very beautifully. And somehow I got really hooked. And so then I kind of bumbled along in college with this incredible passion that I sort of, along with my chain smoking and my jazz music singing and this poetry writing. And then I got out into the real world after college, and it had never occurred to me, like, I'd missed the memo that poets don't actually make money. It hadn't occurred to me. I thought I was burning with desire to be a poet, but I had no practical plan. And so for a while, poetry did have to retreat, and I ended up working as a freelance writer and journalist all around New York, for websites, for magazines, and I ended up working for Architecture Magazine and covering the fall of the World Trade Center, from an architectural perspective. But little by little, I really relate to that thing of, poetry creeping back in. I would write at night. And finally, I got this collection together, and I sent it out in the mail, and it won a prize. And then I realized, this is something I'm doing, and it's here to stay. But in my grown-up life, I've basically woven together a lot of kind of journalistic and long-form freelance writing, and then kind of found my way into a few professorial positions. I don't have a PhD. I'm not an academic in that way. But it's this hybrid practice of nonfiction writing, and then real market-driven writing, like how to pitch a story, how to craft a magazine pitch. I've definitely, have a business as well. And then I have this other sort of a wildly unmarketable poetic calling that I just tend to as best I can.
It's kind of a nice counterpoint to the business of writing. I mean, that they're so very different from each other. They're almost totally different professions. So it's nice to have the two bookends, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Dean, do you want to jump in and sort of talk about your point of entry into poetry and how it lured you in?
Wow. Well, the lure of poetry can be powerful, as you know. I grew up in a farm town in Oklahoma. My family, they were not readers, except for my grandparents, who also lived in the same small town. They were voracious readers, and my grandmother was a former teacher. But my parents didn't really read. In fact, my parents had not graduated from college. So I didn't really grow up loving poetry much in high school, or reading for that matter. I was an athlete. And I liked to read. I would be like the only high school kid reading a book on, basketball trips. I would be teased for like reading, a Bernard Malamud book on the way to Fort Cobb to play basketball or something. But in college, I sort of gradually migrated to becoming an English major, and I was a newly declared English major like my junior year, and we were assigned just the vague requirement to take this poetry anthology that we had. It's called, I still have the anthology, as a matter of fact. I show it to my students sometimes. I was supposed to just read through it, and if there's anything that caught our eye, talk about it. And I was sitting in the cafeteria thumbing through it, and I came across these two pages. On the left-hand side were three W.S. Merwin poems. On the right-hand side were three James Wright poems. And I remember reading those poems and feeling like the room was moving away from me. It was this kind of surreal experience. I'd never read anything like those poems. And I remember thinking that if this was out there in the world and this was considered poetry, like what else was out there that I didn't know about? And that wound up evolving into, I think, a kind of challenge that could I write something that would make someone else feel the way that these poems, these six poems, made me feel? And I think the answer to that question played out over the next, 15 years probably. I wound up going to grad school. I went to a program that had a graduate translation program and graduate creative writing program and comparative literature, and I studied translation. I took graduate creative writing workshops. I took art history classes. And wound up getting an MA and a PhD in comparative literature, really thinking I was going to do translation. And writing poems all the while and doing translation badly. And again, a lot like Tess, over time, writing poems, sending poems out, I realized that I probably had enough poems for a book. And gave myself a year to sort of round out the manuscript, put the manuscript together, write new poems, and start sending it out. And I got really lucky that the manuscript got taken right away. And now I think of myself as someone who is primarily a poet, but who wears all these hats: translator, scholar, reviewer. But once poetry sort of digs its claws into you, it's kind of hard to pull it out. It's there. Even no matter what I write, I always find myself coming back to poetry. It feels really like home.
Yeah, yeah. I'm always just in awe when I see what poets can do from a fiction writer's standpoint, and that, just the right word choice, just the right comma, just the right white space. I'm like, that's just incredible that you're able to do that. Kim, you had said at some point, and I thought it was interesting, that because your poems are so intimate and they feel so revealing, and you made some comment in an interview about how you want your readers not to see your life in poems, but to see their own life in poems. And mm-hmm. I thought how true that was, how intimate your poems were. And I thought maybe that was a way that you could start talking about your latest collection, Last Train to a Missing Planet, and kind of take us into what you were thinking about when the collection came together, and just kind of take us into it a little bit.
Yeah. Well, with the second book, I think, Slice of Moon, I was lucky enough to be on the Book Soup bestseller list. I had done a reading there, and I had a lot of people come. And so it was on the bestseller list for that week, but it was under nonfiction. And I thought, I looked at it. I was so happy to see it there. And then I thought, wow, people really do consider poetry to be nonfiction. I got really embarrassed. And because thinking about so many of my poems, as you say, they do appear, they feel very intimate. And I realized that people think what we write in our poems are true. These are things that are true. Yet you can be a fiction writer and write about a character who murders, a whole town, and no one thinks that you really are a murderer. So poetry is tricky because people feel like you are revealing your inner life, and oftentimes it's a persona, and you're making the stuff up just like all writers do. And when I wrote that article, actually, for Publishers Weekly about why do people think poetry is nonfiction, and I wanted to make that clear, that exactly what you quoted, that when someone reads a poem of mine, I hope they see themselves and not me. I hope that the poem leaves me, the speaker, and becomes part of them. It's like Dean said, those poems moved him so much, he felt like he was almost hallucinating. I don't know if he said that, Dean, or I just made that up.
No, it felt like that, for sure.
Feels like that, and I think that we write poems, obviously, as Tess has said, we're not writing them for the paycheck. We write poetry because we have to. We don't have a choice. And when you get up and you start to write something and the poem starts to come out, it's not because we're choosing to sit there and write a poem. Not for me, anyway. So I think with this collection, this third collection, I did become, after it was published, I became a little self-conscious when I remember that people think these poems are all really about me. And was that your question?
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. And then just kind of take us into the collection itself and how it came together, how this collection maybe differs from the ones that came before it, and, kind of what was on your mind.
Well, the poems, the collection is not about one thing, so it's not like I wanted to write all poems about the devastation of an earthquake or this or that. The poems were written in the course of 2-year period, and I guess the only thing that brings them together is what people write about them, which is I take very small moments in life and in our days, and I sort of project them, or I find something valuable in things that maybe no one else would notice, which to me is what all poetry is. So I don't know why mine are special for that reason, but I think people tend to say that my poems are very accessible and friendly and funny, and the depth comes underneath. You have to read it the second time. But this collection is not as funny, and I think that it's a little darker, and I think it deals more with mortality than perhaps the first two did. And I'm not, I never try to be funny. I don't think you can try to be funny when you're writing. You're either funny or not. But it's the way you see the world. And the first two collections, I saw things in a funnier way than maybe I did in this collection. So there's still humor and there's still some laughs. But I believe, I want to think that these poems go deeper and maybe they're not as... I don't want to say easy to digest, because they're not as fun on the surface.
Yeah.
I think.
You know what poem comes to mind when you're talking about this? I'm flipping through the book and I can't see the title right now, but it's something about a postman peeing, a mailman peeing on a fence. And it starts out very fun. And I don't know if you have the collection there. Maybe you can read it to us. But
yeah,
it starts out very funny. And then there's a twist, and it's, not funny at all. It's very sad.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's a good example of, I guess, what I do, is that it starts off, you think the poem is going in one direction, and then it really takes a turn. I'd be happy to read that if you
want.
Yeah,
please do, yeah.
It's called My Mailman Pees on the Gate by the Dumpster. My mailman pees on the gate by the dumpster. I've seen him do it twice. My coworker, she's seen him too, was afraid to tell me for obvious reasons. And when she told me, I couldn't believe her because it was too repulsive to picture. But I just saw him just now, again, downstairs. I was about to throw my trash away, the end of my workday. It's dark, and there he was. His back facing me, arms disappearing into the garbage bin. So I looked away fast, scared he might turn, see me, see him, try to kill me so I wouldn't tell the police. We've all heard the stories. Postal worker goes mad. Maybe because someone saw them peeing outside in close proximity where they deliver the mail. And from now on, when I reach my hand into the cold metal box, it will be with trepidation, disgust, but also sadness, imagining growing old, losing control alone at dusk, with nothing but other people's bills and invitations stuffed into the bag, tugging at my shoulder, which burns from the weight, fingers too stiff to unbutton the uniform I once wore so proudly back when I didn't need to pee with devastating urgency, when I delivered my letters clean, immaculate, my keychain shining, dangling, engraved, Mommy's Favorite Mailman.
That was Kim Dower reading from Last Train to the Missing Planet, her latest collection out now. Something that we were talking about earlier, Dean, that Kim was saying about what you reveal and what you don't reveal in your poetry. And I know your collection is coming out self-portrait, but you had a lot of self-portrait thoughts. And I was wondering if you wanted to weigh in on that idea of poetry as personally revealing, or if you see it more as Kim does, which is a way to kind of hold a mirror up to the reader.
Well, I think at its best, poetry is both, right? I mean, one of the things that poets do, and I think this is very similar to what nonfiction writers do. In fact, I tell my students that poetry is more like nonfiction, creative nonfiction, than it is like fiction, because in those instances, when you use the I or you're writing about yourself, it's both you and not you, a version of you, a persona of you, or some sort of part of you that is maybe me and maybe not wholly me. And so for me, these self-portraits are, I think of them as faux self-portraits. They're self-portraits as, you know, two characters from Greek mythology in conversation, or self-portrait as Frog and Toad doing something, you know, that Frog and Toad would not normally do. So I think that science is telling us that the self is formulated not through some individual forging, but rather through interaction, right? Who we are is based on who our friends are, where we live, what we do, right? The self is not continuous. The self is always being made and remade. And I'm really interested in this notion of exploring and remaking the self based on external factors like the books you read or the art you look at or the music you listen to or who you love or even who you hate. So I think that the self that we reveal is one of many possible selves.
I love it. So take us a little bit into self-portrait as Wikipedia entry. I couldn't get my hands on it because it's not out yet. But kind of tell us how that collection came together and what was on your mind when you put it together.
So the title, self-portrait as Wikipedia entry, is there's an actual poem with that title that appeared in Ziziva a couple of years ago, and there's actually a fun online version on their website that has hot links. And so it's a poem that is in the form of a Wikipedia entry. And I got the idea for that poem because someone put together a Wikipedia page for me, and at the time, and I think probably still, it was riddled with errors, a kind of funny inaccuracies. And even for a while, I would go in and try to add even crazier fake stuff, and they would wind up getting taken out, whatever I would add, but the other fake things would just stay in there. And I thought, what a funny idea for a poem to write a poem that is in the form of a Wikipedia entry that is a mixture of actual truths, fake truths, and then perhaps true truths that wouldn't appear in a Wikipedia entry, which tend to be biological facts as opposed to philosophical beliefs or religious beliefs or things like that. So the poem emerged from this kind of marriage of interesting details. And my publisher, Copper Canyon, and I agreed that this might be an interesting title for the book because the book itself is pretty political. And it basically asks the question, are the materials that we use to make our own sense of self the same materials that a nation uses to make its sense of self? Or to put in the language of self-portraiture, the palette that you use to sketch the self, is it the same palette that a nation uses to sketch nationhood? So it asks these large questions about the relationship between who you are and what a country is.
Mm. Do you have that poem in front of you? Can you share some or
part? The self-portrait is Wikipedia entry?
Yeah.
I do. It's not a short poem.
Do you want to read a stanza or two, or would that screw it up? I just wanted to give our listeners a taste of one of your poems. Or if there's another that's better, we could do that too. Totally your call.
Well, I'll read, it's just in one, stanza.
Okay.
And so I'll read it. So it's self-portrait as Wikipedia entry. And if anyone is listening near a computer, you can just type in that and Zizova and go straight to the poem. And I would say that this poem, again, is a mixture of actual things and not true things. Self-portrait as Wikipedia entry. Dean Rader was born in Stockton, California during the summer of love. His sorrow is his own. He believes in star sting and misnomer. He carries a toy whistle in his pocket. American by nationality, he was conceived in a Fiat near the Place du Châtelet. If asked, Rader will lie and say he doesn't remember, but his lazy eyes and hunched back give him away. His left pinky finger, broken from years of basketball, has never healed, which he attributes to the caesura of distance and longing. His heart, the size of a normal man's heart, has been used as a model for a forensic mannequin. As a young boy, he once carried a small package to the river, but it was the wrong address. If asked to describe the river, he quotes Van Heisenstadt, quote, die Grenzen des Wassers nicht vom Erinnerung, end quote. Rader is not the little cricket. He is not a scissors for lefty. His soul, the size of a tiny condom, slides quickly onto time's blind spot. In 2004, he was asked about time's blind spot, but responded only that, quote, time, like a bandage, is always already wound and unwound, end quote. Once, as a student in college, he grew a third sideburn. Darkness, his maquette. Darkness, his morning coffee. Rader's father studied to be a mortician. His mother was a therapist, and not surprisingly, Rader pursued both. His head, matted with crude sketches of benches, nipples, and flower petals, is roughly the size of the Place du Châtelet. Strong at math from an early age, he helped develop what has come to be known as the Osaka postulate, which proves that the square root of a syndeton is equal to the n sphere of trespass, skin spark, and elegy. As for his own spiritual beliefs, Rader is silent, though one of his recent poems, entitled The Last Day of 34, suggests an influence of Simone Weil. Quote, community is work. For all I know, God may be in both. For all you know, God may be both. End quote. And Luigi Sacramone. We want so much. we only believe in what we ask for. Considered neither the lip blister nor the noodle wrench, Rader has emerged at least somewhat as a repetitio rerum. In more recent work, he denies this, though indirectly, citing instead his commitment to interlocutory boundaries, what he calls bornage, through what he calls the phatic interstice. At present, his voice, the pitch and timbre of a young girl's, asks only for tang. Consumed by his charity work with the NGO, Our Uncle of Instrumentality, he has stopped writing entirely. When questioned about this at a 2007 fundraiser, Rader quipped, quote, "Let my words say what I cannot," end quote. Since then, a fragment of an unpublished poem attributed to Rader has started to appear on the Internet. "Line up and line out," says the moon whittle. "Loss is the ring on our finger, the bright gem compassing every step as we drop down. Believe in what you know, and you'll go blind. Experts doubt its authenticity."
That was Dean Rader reading Self-Portrait as Wikipedia entry. That is the title of his forthcoming collection. And you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. We are doing a poetry panel today with Kim Dower, talking about her latest collection, Last Train to the Missing Planet, Tess Taylor, Work and Days, and Dean Rader with his upcoming collection, Self-Portrait. So Tess, why don't I know that you had won an ability to live in this cottage for a while, and from that sprung Work and Days. And I was wondering if you could sort of talk about that, talk about the collection, and kind of take us into it.
Sure. In some ways, this collection is actually real in the sense that it traces a real year that I worked on a real farm in Massachusetts. And the way that came to be was through a series of strange events. I was finishing a first book. I had just gotten married. And I won this fellowship to live in a house that had been left by a MacArthur Fellow winning poet who was deceased, but she left her house for poets to live in. And all I had to do was show up in this three-bedroom cottage in the Berkshires of Massachusetts and work on poems for a year. But this was terrifying to me. I had been circling living in Brooklyn and circling the worlds of New York City as a freelancer. I'd worked about, you know, six jobs and adjuncting and waitressing and, you know, being an assistant for a theater maven. I had had this series of odd jobs, and now I was about to have this year of quiet. And, you know, I'm a Berkeley kid. I have worked in gardens my whole life. I've worked in community gardens my whole life. And even in Brooklyn, with all of that, I was helping to coordinate a community garden in Brooklyn. And so I talked to the people who offered the fellowship, and I said, you know, this year sounds really intense. I want to find a way to build community, get exercise, get out of the house. Can I volunteer at a community garden? And they looked at me funny, and they were like, this is a rural area. We don't have community gardens, but we do have farms. So that was how I was going to spend my fellowship year, volunteering on a farm a few days a week, partly just to keep from going nuts and to keep doing some writing. But I wasn't thinking, okay, I'm going to make a project out of it. And I got out to Massachusetts, and I started working, and I went and met the farmer, and she was like, well, you know, we're going to call you the first day that it's warm enough to be on the field, and wait for the phone call. First day of the thaw, we spent moving stones. And I spent a whole day moving rocks, and it wasn't boring. It was totally fascinating to be with people preparing this field. We unrolled burlap. As the weather got warmer, we set up the greenhouse. And this was this three-acre farm that served local restaurants in the Berkshires, farmers market, 80 families as community-supported agriculture. And I'd always been on the receiving end of that kind of stuff. I mean, I'm the kind of person who gets a farm box and cares a lot about sustainable agriculture and small-scale agriculture. But this was my first chance to actually be on a farm doing that work. So it was just really interesting to me in a kind of nonfiction way. and it was also interesting to me in a really physical and beautiful way. And I ended up jotting stuff down in my notebook just because it was very physical, very sensual, very present tense. But, of course, I was staying in a poet's cottage, and it happened that the poet's cottage itself was full of books of poetry that reflect the fact that writing about farming is one of our deep preoccupations that goes all the way back to Hesiod, who's the one who wrote the very first book called Work and Days. And I started reading farm poetry and thinking about how weird it was to be farming as a woman on a community-supported agriculture at the end of the 21st century or the beginning of the 21st century, and thinking, like, this is, you know, trying to connect to nature now in the face of this kind of disrupted environment is very different than maybe, you know, a straightforward pastoral poem might have been, you know, 200 or 300 years ago. And I started thinking about how to write farm poems that speak to this sort of apocalyptic climate that we live in, farm poems for climate change. So bringing all of that kind of Berkeley foodie stuff to bear, but also reading John Clare and Hesiod and Virgil's Georgics and the, sort of the deep classics, and kind of trying to reconcile the past and the present. So in some ways, this is nonfiction, and in another, you know, in the sense that it's autobiographical, but in another sense, it's also deeply engaging through a whole history of a genre of writing, the farm poem.
Yeah, yeah.
Asking, so, like, what does it mean to do that now in the present?
And I hadn't realized that Work and Days and Works and Days is a tradition of poets, and you both you and Dean have collections with that title. Because I'm so ignorant, go ahead.
This thing, when in fact that was when I met Dean, I was like already halfway through drafting this book, and Dean, who was a lovely guy, was like sending out books and found me and said, "Hey, I think your work is interesting. Let's be friends." Sent me his book, and I thought, "Well, yeah, we can be friends, but you're going to hate me when later down the line you find out that I'm writing the same title book as you." But Dean is way too gracious to hate me, right, Dean?
That's right.
Plus, Hesiod invented that title in 700 BC. So I feel like we can share it.
You can share it. Right, right.
He wouldn't mind.
He's okay.
Yeah,
he's a giver.
And in fact, there's another book called Work and Days by a woman, Bernadette Mayer, who's a great experimental poet. And she published a different one called Works and Days this spring. So I guess, you know, it's almost like a thing you can do. It's like a riff on a theme.
No, I love it. I love it. So can you take us into one of your poems? Can you read one of yours as well?
Sure. Was there any that had caught you, or should I just jump in?
There was. There were a lot that caught me as I'm flipping through here. I liked May Day. Can you read May Day?
Sure.
Even though it's not May anymore, but it was.
No, it's not May anymore. So one of the things that's so cool, I mean, I'm a Californian, like, you know, in my growing up. And so one of the things that's exotic about Massachusetts is the absolute arc of every week in time. And this year, kind of, this book traces a year. And you can, you know, the time is passing in the light. In California, I think we get, it just sort of gets a little darker in the winter and gets a little warmer in the spring. And we have these kind of radical off-season cycles of when it's dry and when it's wet. But so I love this relentlessness of the arc of the weather in Massachusetts, and this poem kind of speaks to that a little bit. Yeah. May Day. They go, the early flags, the gory maples, so too the daffodils and Lenten roses. Other petals swirl and nights warm. Buds thicken and cast shadows. In a thunderstorm, I almost forget the ice that was. Narcissi speckle watery paths, meadows heap up emerald masses. How green, and I want to delight, except this undertow. It pulls so fast, passing before I recognize it. Like souls in Dante who can't see the present, white lilacs fertile in pre-summer heat. The parade I barely noticed was beginning is already halfway down the street.
I love that. I love Dante, so I think I was drawn into that. That is Tess Taylor reading from her work, Work and Days. The poem was May Day. So you talked to so many people, writers, people in general, who you say poetry and it's almost like you say calculus. You know, you can watch the freeze go over their face and they're like, I don't understand it. I can't do it. And, you know, particularly Kim and Dean, you show us that there's a different way to poetry that really is, you know, the kinder, gentler poetry. And so what do you kind of tell people to calm them down, to make them feel like you too, you know, no matter your background, can enjoy a poem, and kind of make it more accessible if anybody wants to jump in on that topic?
You know, I find that one of the saddest things when people say, oh, poetry, I don't read poetry, or I don't like poetry. And I think Amy Gerstler, who's an amazing poet, said it very clearly. She edited one of the anthologies of American poetry a couple of years ago. And she said, when people say to her, I don't like poetry, it's like saying, I don't like food. Hmm. And, I mean, basically, there's poetry for anybody. There's something that you're going to like to eat. There's one thing that you can find. And, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with the way we're taught poetry, and it does seem like math. And poetry, in a way, is like math if you count the beats and all these things. But poetry should be fun and accessible and easy to step into. And I don't know. I think any of us who teach have that ability to turn people on. I think it was you know, Tess said at the beginning that she had a very charismatic teacher who got her excited. I think that, like anything in life, you have someone who's passionate about something or excited, and they say, you've got to listen to this poem, and you read it aloud, which really needs to be done with poetry, you'll turn anyone on with the right poem at the right moment. And, you know, I guess any of us who write have that as part of our mission, is to get people excited about what we love.
Yeah, right.
Paul Muldoon, who's the poetry editor of The New Yorker right now and just a wonderful Irish poet, was kind of said, he quipped. He said that poetry either has to be everywhere, at, like film, or completely banned like cocaine. And either way, that would make it so that people knew how to use it.
I like that. I like that. Well, there are these cities that have poetry, and now I'm drawing a blank, but I know I've seen them, you know, like if you're in the subway and they have poems up on the wall or, the, you know, where they're...
In motion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The poetry in motion.
That program is sponsored through the Poetry Society of America a lot of times, and it's part of their mission to keep bringing it, and they're working, you know, maybe other cities have it through different things. But I think it's great because, you know, Dean and I are actually really hoping that it'll come to San Francisco soon. I think just that sense that, hey, this is out there, this is everywhere. There's a thing in Boston where there's poems that are hidden on the sidewalk, and then when it rains, they become clear, and you can see them in the rain. I think that's, you know, fantastic. I think stealth poetry is one way to go. Yeah. But I also think people just have to stop being... I think that teachers get this... Teachers are... also responsible for not getting the deer in the headlights look and finding something pleasurable to talk about and not necessarily sort of drilling in prosody or making people feel like poetry is about the fact that something's going to be hidden from them, but just allowing people to talk about what about poetry is pleasurable. So Dean knows this, but I host this series where we pair poetry with wine.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, people get really anxious about talking about wine as well. They think, oh, I'm not going to know the right words. I'm not going to say overtones of cherry. But when you give people a glass of wine and you say, hey, enjoy this wine and then know that this poem is going to go with it, people suddenly relax and realize that the whole experience is supposed to be about pleasure and that there's not going to be a quiz at the end. It's really just to make your life feel more delicious.
Yeah.
And richer.
I like that. I like that. Talk a little bit about teaching poetry, and when you teach it, you can teach other poems, I think, but how do you teach people to write poems? I mean, you can say, here's, you know, Wordsworth, and this is why it's great. But is it possible to teach people rhythm and word choice and what's pleasurable? And I mean, it almost sounds like it's trying to teach perfect pitch or something to someone.
Dean, do you want to jump in there? I mean, I have that.
Sure. I mean, I'll also just respond to your earlier question. I agree with Kim and Tess entirely.
I think that everyone is a poetry person. Everyone's a poetry person. In fact, everyone that you talk to, when they were a kid, they wrote poems, and they loved poetry. I mean, you go into, I do this with my son's class, and like, you know, National Poetry Month. If you go in and you say, today's poetry day, everyone's excited. And even the boys. And then sometime, you know, in junior high or high school, you know, there's the surly junior high boy who will say, ah, poetry sucks. But somehow they've been taught to think that poetry sucks, and it's perhaps used as a kind of Rubik's Cube, where if you don't have the secret knowledge, you're just not going to unlock some hidden meaning. And one of the great disservices people have done to poetry is to make readers feel stupid if they don't get poetry. And really, I think poetry at its best makes readers feel smart. Mm. That's really what it's there for. It makes you feel smart because you feel like you've gotten something that is that goes beyond a logical level. And so I think it's pretty easy to teach students to like poetry because the bar they have is so low. And I actually really love I'm a professor at University of San Francisco, and I love teaching non-majors poetry because, I mean, give me three class periods, and by the end, they're like, kind of like I was, and that is, oh my God, I didn't know that this was poetry and that you could read it in this way and just find pleasure. And I think that teaching poetry is very similar. In fact, I've just developed like an intro poetry workshop for non-English majors that I'm going to be teaching for the first time in the fall. And it's so fun to get these economics and political science majors and nursing majors and psychology majors and sociology majors, because everyone wants to write poetry. And again, I would say, I think everyone does write poetry. It might not be the best poetry, but in their journals or in their diaries or late at night after too much alcohol or when they're heartbroken, people are writing poems. And that's mm-hmm. because we associate poetry with intense emotion and revelation and feeling. And I would even say, a kind of prayer, a kind of secular prayer. I think often it puts us in touch with the divine. And I think that one way of just getting students involved in writing poems is just to teach them about poetic history and poetic form and let them revel in the possibility of writing bad poems and understanding there's really nothing at stake in writing a bad poem, whatever bad might mean. And let them just enjoy language. I really, really think that once people realize that poetry is just as much about language and the pleasures of language as it is about some hidden meaning or motif or message, they're going to enjoy it much the same way they would enjoy a song or a prayer or a painting.
Mm. Anyone else?
Yeah, I definitely think it's a sense that can be really, you know, cultivated in, you know, in just a few gestures towards appreciation. You know, that they've done studies that show that with wine tasting or with listening to symphonies, either of those things, that if people take two classes in it, their appreciation of what they're tasting or what they're hearing just goes up, and then they have a richer experience of, you know, their own life. And I think that poetry is the same way, that with, you know, you begin to introduce some questions about why a thing is pleasurable and how it's made, and just allow yourself the time to savor. And people, you know, once they stimulate their senses, they kind of latch onto that. I mean, it's really fun to get to feel your life a little more deeply or to observe the world a little more deeply. The book, Work and Days, to come back to that title, you know, Hesiod, that poet, was writing that collection at the same time that Homer was writing the Odyssey. And Homer was doing something that poetry has done that was really important, which is to solidify the history of people. It used to be that poetry was the way that we remembered our entire culture. you know, the history of war or whatever, the history of you know, which of our ancestors went into battle and, you know, where our culture had been. I mean, that's one of the roles of poetry, to actually be a rememberer in that way. But Work in Days was this other kind of remembering that Hesiod was solidifying, which was just how to take care of the earth and how to take care of your life. How to tend your bees, how to raise vegetables, how to raise cattle. And I come back to that idea about the poem as a kind of a how-to manual. What if the poem was actually like a wonderful way of learning how to see and observe and feel, and I guess I come back to that word again, savor, be alert to your senses.
I just want to say,
and so I kind of just offer that to my students as a going in point, and we sort of take off from there. And then in terms of things like word choice, they can be taught. You know, you can. It's not to say that there's one word that's more right than another, but if you give people a really great poem and you take out some of the best adjectives that really give it that knifey feeling that really inspire, and then you kind of can give people a multiple choice chance to fill in the blanks like a Mad Lib with adjectives, it's really interesting to watch how people get the sense of how one word versus another can kind of deliver more power or more punch or more flavor. And, you know, again, it's not that one is more right or another is wrong. It's not about it's, but it's about allowing people to have pleasure in the fact that language is sensual and means on all these different levels and sounds beautiful, and, you know, that a really good constellation of words can move you.
Yeah.
And can,
yeah, yeah.
You
Kim,
know,
Kim, jump in. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that I it's all fascinating, but for me, basically, when I have a chance to teach it, or for myself personally, what I think many people would relate to much more simply than the largeness of what poetry is supposed to do, I more subscribe to the Gregory Orr idea of poetry as survival. Hmm. Poetry for many people, and young people, I think particularly, to think of poetry as survival, like, people need to understand the inexplicable. And there are so many things that happen to us every day, and young people, particularly ideas, questions that they have, that poetry can be an anchor, that they don't see it that way, that to just write down your thoughts and feelings, and I'm not talking about bad poem, good poem, because that shouldn't even come into play when you're starting, but just to see how writing certain lines or feelings can put order into what you have not been able to make order out of.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one thing that I learned years ago is to sort of take poems, have a playlist, have like we have on our iPod or whatever, use poems that way. Pick 5, 10, 15 poems, keep adding to it, and have a catalog, a little book of our own of people's poems that we love that we can go back to when we need something, when we need to understand something. I have one, and it changes all the time. It used to be all Frank O'Hara or maybe Sharon Olds or, you know, but things that I needed to look at to make sense for myself. And for me, that's what poetry is. And when I became so impassioned by it and excited, is to help me understand things. And then you lie, and then you make different characters and different situations, and you flip it. To take it a step away from yourself. But to me, if we could teach poetry as survival, more than anything else, more than any other art form, maybe music, but I think students would be so attracted to it and so excited by it.
I love that. I love that. We're drawing down on our time, but I want to give each of you an outro to tell us where we can find you online. You all have wonderful websites if you're going to be around any of those things. Dean, maybe we'll start with you and tell us how to find more about you.
Well, I do have a website. It's just deanrader.com. Dean Rader, all one word. And there are sample poems, links to reviews and books and other writings.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. You have this really wonderful poem on Frog and Toad. The New Yorker did a big thing on Frog and Toad yesterday, so that was great. And your poetry collection comes out early next year?
Yeah, I actually have two books coming out next year. One comes out officially in February, Self-Portrait as Wikipedia Entry with Copper Canyon, and then a book of collaborative sonnets that I wrote with this wonderful poet in Chicago named Simone Minch. We have a book coming out called Suture of sonnets we wrote together with Black Lawrence Press in April.
Awesome. Tess?
My website is www.tessmiddlescoretaylor.com. And I just wanted to, I know that you're recording down in the Los Angeles area. I just wanted to do a plug that some wonderful poets, often from Red Hen, are going to be at the Annenberg Beach House on summer solstice, 6:30, as the great summer sun is going down. And I'll be there as well. So if anyone in Los Angeles would like to come, I'd love to see you.
Perfect. Kim?
Well, Tess, I'll be reading with you. Did you know that?
I know. I'm so excited.
Yeah, so that's June 21st at Annenberg. And my site is just kimdowerpoetry.com, and it has the three books there. And anyone in Los Angeles who's going to want to come to the Pasadena Literary Festival on Saturday, I'll be reading there with Ron Kirchy, who's another wonderful poet. We'll be reading at 1:30 at the festival. And anyone in Santa Cruz, I'll be at the Bookshop Santa Cruz on June 14th.
Oh, and that's a great place to read. They're lovely.
Yeah,
people.
Santa Cruz is so fun.
Oh, I'm excited for that. I really am. And then the 21st at the Annenberg. So a lot of exciting things going on.
I love it. You three were really the perfect people to take our hand and lead us kindly and gently into the world of poetry. It's funny because I put something up on Facebook this morning, and the only I got a lot of likes, but the only comment that I got was somebody saying, I don't know anything about poetry. I don't understand poetry, so this will be great. And you know, all three of these books were just complete delights in terms of, as you say, accessible humor, beautiful, and as Kim said, it's a great way to kind of hold a mirror up and see your life reflected in all the refracted in all of the poems. So, God, thanks so much, you guys. This was really, really great.
Thanks, Marie.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thanks, Kim.
Thanks, Cass. Great to hear you guys.
Thanks, guys.
All right, that's all the time we have for today. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. Nicole will be on. Until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.
Bye.